Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the UN in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 13th of May. I'm happy to see you all. And for this briefing, which is quite dense, so I'll start immediately, une fois n'est pas coutume, comme on dit en français, by giving the floor to Zaina, who has a quick announcement, which she has to leave. So Zaina, your announcement on the conference.
Mano. Yeah, no, okay, sorry. Good morning, everybody. I just have a couple of quick announcements to share with you. Three, as opposed to two. The first one is, as you probably know, the International Labour Conference will take place this year between the 2nd and the 13th of June at the Palais des Nations. And this is when we have government workers and employers delegates from 187 member states coming together to discuss some of the most important issues for the ILO this year and for the world of work. This year, the agenda includes a second discussion on a proposed convention on the protection against biological hazards at work, a first discussion on the decent work in the platform economy, and a general discussion on innovative approaches to tackle informality and promoting formal work. We're also going to have a discussion on the ILO's contribution to the upcoming Second World Summit for Social Development, which is taking place in Qatar later on this year. And we'll also be having a special tripartite committee discussion on changes to the Maritime Labour Convention. Beyond that, the discussions will also cover reports of the chairperson of the governing body and the director general, including the situation in the occupied Arab territories and a draft program for the budget for 2026 and 2027. The Global Coalition for Social Justice will hold its second annual forum, and that's going to be taking place on the 12th of June, 2025. It'll be attended by coalition partners and tripartite delegations at the conference. Full details are available on our website, ILO website, including more details on the work of the different committees. And as always, Palais-accredited journalists it's open to them and they're welcome to join. I'm also pleased to share with you that our Director General, Gilbert Efungo, will be holding a DG breakfast for Palais-accredited journalists on the 28th of May, ahead of the ILC, and in order to launch the upcoming ILO World Employment and Social Outlook Trends 2025, the spring issue. The breakfast will be taking place from 10 to 11 a.m. We will, of course, be sending full information to you via email, as we always do, and we will obviously respectfully request that you make sure you're in the building by 9:30, 9:45. And last but not least, I wanted to share this with you today, so when you get an email about it, you're not a little bit confused by all the different emails from the ILO. We have a new report coming out in which we introduce an AI index, which is the most detailed global assessment to date on how generative AI is reshaping the world of work and jobs in particular. The index is a snapshot of how AI could transform occupation and employment across countries. And this will be coming out on the 20th of May. That's it from me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Zaina. Is there any question to ILO? Emma?
Hi, Zaina. That sounds really interesting, that report. Will it be available under embargo, please?
We're hoping.
Mike.
Oh. I think it was on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Fancy for me.
No,
fancy.
We're hoping it will be, Emma. Yeah, but we'll give more information on that. Yeah, thanks.
Interviews as well?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Yeah.
Any other question to ILO in the room? I see that Moussa has a question for you. Bonjour, Moussa.
Bonjour, merci Alessandra. Bonjour Zaina. Vous avez dit que les accrédités aux Nations Unies peuvent entrer. Est-ce que, parce que normalement, il y a toujours des. On doit s'enregistrer avant, donc il y a des mesures à prendre. Est-ce qu'on est libre de venir au ILO sans vraiment des mesures préalables?
Oui, merci pour la question, Moussa. Non, en fait, vous devrez vous enregistrer en ligne et on va envoyer tous ces détails. En fait, on a déjà envoyé les détails, je crois. On a envoyé un Media Advisory la semaine dernière. Et si vous désirez, je peux vous le renvoyer aujourd'hui. Ça vous donne le lien au site web où vous pouvez vous enregistrer.
Mais c'est un enregistrement, ce n'est pas une accréditation.
Non, c'est voilà. Un enregistrement. Donc, vous êtes déjà accrédité comme journaliste du Palais.
Ouais. Exact. Merci beaucoup. Catherine, pardon, tu as encore une question. Pardon.
Oui, bonjour Alessandra, bonjour Zeina. Je voulais que ce soit clair à propos justement de l'enregistrement. La conférence de ILO internationale va se tenir où exactement? Et à ce titre, est-ce que nous avons accès ou pas? Et puis bon, pour le breakfast, nous savons que très gentiment... l'équipe de communication de ILO nous attend toujours à la sécurité et nous accompagne. Donc là, on sait qu'il n'y a pas de problème d'accès.
Ouais.
Merci.
Je vous en prie. Merci pour la question, Catherine. Je suis branchée, ne t'en fais pas. Oui. Justement, vous avez, comme des journalistes accrédités au Palais, vous avez accès à la conférence entière. Il faut juste que vous vous enregistrez en ligne pour la conférence.
Qui se tiendra au Palais des Nations.
Vous m'avez posé cette question aussi. Qui se tiendra ici au Palais des Nations comme l'année dernière et les années auparavant.
Voilà, et merci beaucoup. Alors, Zeina, bonne chance pour les préparatifs. Je me tourne à ma gauche pour donner la bienvenue à Sophia Caltro, parce que, comme vous savez, elle est la directrice du bureau des UN Women ici à Genève. I'll switch to English, Sophia. You have an important announcement on the impact of foreign aid cuts on the situation of women and girls. Thank you.
Thank you, Alessandra. Bonjour à tous. And thank you very much for joining us here today, where we as UN Women is launching this important report titled At the Breaking Point, The Impact of Foreign Aid Cuts on Women's Organization in Humanitarian Crisis Worldwide. And it will now be also posted in the link of this press conference. So this report, it is more than a compilation of surveyed data. It is a wake-up call, and it is an invitation to act. In every crisis, women-led and women's rights organizations step up. They deliver life-saving assistance, they defend rights, and they support their communities, often under immense pressure and with scarce resources. They reach the unreachable, they shape local solutions, and they ensure women's voices are heard. Without women organization, humanitarian responses are less inclusive and less effective. But as this report highlights, many women's organizations are now being stretched to the brink. They are being asked to do more with less, and in some cases, with almost nothing at all. In this survey, 90% of the 411 women's organizations that we have talked to have been financially impacted, with nearly half expecting to shut down within 6 months if current conditions persist. 72% have already had to lay off staff, and 51% has already suspended or terminated programs. The impacts for women and girls in crises are already being catastrophic. Essential services, from gender-based violence response to cash assistance and livelihood support to reproductive health care services, they are all being scaled back. For example, in Afghanistan, more than half of women's organizations say that programs for women are directly affected. This includes the closure of health facilities, forcing women and girls, many of them pregnant, to walk for hours just to access basic health services. Safe spaces and women's centers that once provided essential GBV support have also been sheltered, leaving survivors with nowhere to turn. And in Ukraine, over 70% of women's organizations report major disruptions, and many have already suspended shelters, legal aid, and trauma support for survivors of the conflict. This represents a challenge to our collective commitment to gender equality, protection, and accountability. And all of this comes as humanitarian needs, as we know, continue to rise. Today, 308 million people across 73 countries need humanitarian assistance, according to the latest survey by OCHA. And in 2023 alone, 612 million women and girls lived within 50 kilometers of a conflict zone. That is 50% higher than a decade ago. The effect of war, climate disasters, food insecurity, and displacement are converging, with devastating consequences for the lives of women and girls. And yet, even in this context, less than 1% of bilateral aid to conflict-affected settings goes to women organizations. Less than 1%. So at UN Women, we think we must ask ourselves, how can we meaningfully support locally-led responses without financially backing the organizations best positioned to lead them? And how can we advance gender equality in crisis response without resourcing the women's organizations that are driving that work every day within their communities? Still, this report that we launched today is not just about loss, it is also about resilience. Women's organizations are adapting. They are mobilizing, advocating, and innovating to sustain their work. But they should not have to do this alone. Our report is clear about what women's organizations are asking for. They want a seat at the table where funding decisions are made, especially when cuts are on the line. And they want stronger advocacy from the international community to protect gender equality financing, to be able to do their work, their life-saving work for women and girls worldwide. They also want support in building coalitions, strengthen organizational capacity, and sustaining their work in increasingly challenging environments. These aren't unrealistic demands. They are demands that are essential for a more inclusive, effective, and accountable humanitarian system. That is why we are here, not just to share findings, but to issue a clear call. So UN Women, we call donors to urgently identify flexible direct funding for women's organizations working in crisis to ensure that these organizations are crucial for women and the crucial work for women and girls is protected. And the report that we are releasing here today gives us the evidence. Now we need to take it seriously and act with the urgency and solidarity that this stark moment demands. Thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions, of course.
Thank you very much, Sophia. Is there any question in the room? I don't see hands up. And yes, Sema, Reuters.
Hi, good morning. Sorry, it's just a clarification point. I'm sorry, have you already sent out the report?
Okay. Michel Langrand, Geneva Solutions Online.
Yeah, hi, thank you. Thanks for the briefing. I had a question regarding US funding to UN Women and also UNFPA, which last week issued a statement condemning the fact that the US would deny any future funding to the organization. I'm just wondering how, I don't know what the situation, first of all, is with UN Women in terms of US funding, but other than that, how concerned are you with the impact of, you know, of course, foreign cuts in general, but specifically the US, which is a major funder of gender-related programs and activities of the UN. How concerned are you by these cuts and how that would will affect UN work on this issue? Thank you.
Thank you very much. So in this report, we do not mention any specific donors. We really focus on the impact of women-led organizations that, as mentioned, are very much bearing the brunt of this funding crisis. And what we see is, of course, that their ability to do their work out in their local communities is severely affected by the funding cuts overall. But then, of course, any funding cuts to UN Women affects our ability to reach women and girls in need. need. And of course, also from our end, we see how a wide range of critical programs and services for women and girls have been affected. That includes shelter, healthcare, peace building, income generating activities, safe spaces, etc. And specifically then on the US suspension of foreign assistance, for us, it currently affects around 40 million of our project funding. Of course, this is an impact that will unfold over time. It includes multi-year funding agreements and so forth, so it's difficult to say anything more precise. But of course, all funding cuts that we see are having a devastating effect, especially on local women-led organizations and their ability to assist women in need in conflict situations from Afghanistan to Ukraine to Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sophia. I don't see other questions for you. Thank you very much for presenting us this report. Let me turn now to Liz. Liz, let's stay with the US. You have a point briefing on that. Go ahead.
Yes. Good morning, everybody. As you may have seen, we have just issued a press release on the US, and I will highlight some of the points made in it. The deportation over recent months of large numbers of non-nationals from the United States of America, especially to countries other than those of their origin, raises a number of human rights concerns. According to official US data, between the 20th of January and the 29th of April, 142,000 individuals were deported from the US. In particular, the fate and whereabouts of at least 245 Venezuelans and some 30 Salvadorans removed to El Salvador remain unclear. Many of them were deported under the Alien Enemies Act as alleged members of specific criminal groups. They have reportedly been detained in the Maximum Security Center for Terrorism Confinement, or CECOT, in El Salvador, a facility where detainees are treated particularly harshly, without access to legal counsel or their relatives, or other contact with the outside world. The UN Human Rights Office has information from family members and lawyers regarding more than 100 Venezuelans believed to be held in CECOT. These reports indicate that many of the detainees were not informed of the US government's intention to deport them to be held in a third country, that many did not have access to a lawyer, and that they were effectively unable to challenge the lawfulness of their removal before being flown out of the US. This situation raises serious concerns regarding a wide array of rights that are fundamental to both US and international law. Rights to due process, to be protected from arbitrary detention, to equality before the law, to be protected from exposure to torture or other irreparable harm in other states, and to an effective remedy. To date, no official lists of the detainees have been published by the US or Salvadoran authorities, and their legal status in El Salvador remains unclear. Many family members interviewed by the UN Human Rights Office voiced deep distress at not knowing where and in what circumstances their loved ones are detained. Some only became aware when they recognized their relatives from videos on social media of them either in or being taken to CECOT. According to information received, those removed to El Salvador have been unable so far effectively to challenge their detention there. Families we've spoken to have expressed a sense of complete powerlessness in the face of what has happened, and their pain at seeing their relatives labeled and handled as violent criminals, even terrorists, without any court judgment as to validity of what is claimed against them. The manner in which some of the individuals were detained and deported, including the use of shackles on them, as well as the demeaning rhetoric used against migrants, has also been profoundly disturbing. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Volker Türk welcomes the essential role that the US judiciary, legal community, and civil society are playing to ensure the protection of human rights in this context. He has called on the US government to take the necessary measures to ensure compliance with due process, to give prompt and full effect to the determination of the courts, to safeguard the rights of children, and to stop the removal of any individual to any country where there is a real risk of torture or other irreparable harm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Liz. Thanks for this briefing. I guess there will be questions. Nina Larson.
Hi, Liz. Thanks for the briefing. I was wondering, given the fact that the whereabouts aren't known for a number of these people, if your office is talking about enforced disappearances. I also had a question about CECOT and if you have any confirmation that there is torture happening there, what kind of contact you've had with El Salvadoran authorities about that, and also to clarify the legal status of these people. And I had a separate question on the U.S., which is on the arrival of white South African refugees to the U.S., what your thoughts are on distinguishing between people, it would seem, on racial grounds, granting those people refugee status and not everyone else. Thank you.
Yes, indeed, lots of questions, and I'll do my best to answer them all in the order that you've asked them. As I said, the families we've spoken to are deeply distressed. Many of them don't know where their loved ones are detained, or really on just what basis. There's no access to them by lawyers or their families, and their legal status in El Salvador remains highly unclear, as we stressed. To date, as we also said, no official list of the detainees or their legal status have been published by the US or Salvadoran authorities. So, taken together, that's a real context of uncertainty. And we know from experience elsewhere in the world that when there is such a situation, there is a higher risk of human rights violations being committed. So that is why precisely we are so concerned and why we have come out with something today. With regard to CECOT in El Salvador, we have colleagues working on El Salvador, primarily from Panama. We have seen the reports about the conditions in CECOT. We've engaged with the Salvadoran authorities, and our call would be that we are given access to CECOT so that we can establish the conditions in which people are being detained. That is terribly important. With regard to white South Africans, I do have some information.
Do you want to go? There are many questions on the same subject. Do you want to answer now?
I can put the South Africans to one side.
Yeah, Nina, if you don't mind, because there are many questions on this subject, so maybe for coherence, let's finish with those. Yeah, you have a follow-up?
Yeah. Sorry, just on my first question. So are you talking about the risk of enforced disappearances?
I think we're deeply concerned precisely given the context, the uncertainty of we don't know what is happening to people, and that would raise concerns indeed that families do not know where their loved ones are. Lawyers do not know where they are. In fact, no one knows where they are for certain, and we don't know the legal basis. So that is raising huge, huge human rights concerns indeed.
Any other question in the room? I'll go to the platform. Nick Amimbrus.
Yeah, good morning, thanks. Following up Nina's question, I'm not quite sure why you aren't already calling it enforced disappearances. And, you know, enforced disappearances is an international humanitarian law crime, and where it's systematic, as would seem to be the case here, and widespread, that would be a crime against humanity. So why are you not sort of calling it out at this level? And a second question, what are your concerns in relation to reports we hear that the administration is proposing to suspend rights of habeas corpus? Thanks.
Thank you. Well, to pick up on what you have asked, Nick, and also what Nina was asking about, it's really to underscore the context, this complete uncertainty, just not knowing what is happening to these people. And of course, then concerns about violations. So indeed, given the circumstances, given the risk of the fear of human rights violations being committed, there may well be concerns of enforced disappearance. And of course, that, you're quite right, it is a really serious issue under international human rights law, Nick. This would have to be looked into. With regard to habeas corpus, I mean, that is a really important fundamental sort of legal point. So, of course, we would be concerned at these reports.
Gabriela?
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Alessandra. Thank you, Liz, for this briefing. Just to clarify, can you remind us how many people are in Salvador jails? I mean, how many do you estimate? The nationalities are is Venezuelan, but there are other nationalities. And who has the responsibility of these people? Is the U.S. government, El Salvador, or both? And did you have any message from Mr. Bukele or any communication with the government, with the Bukele? We saw Bukele with Trump in the White House. They were together in the White House, so they are good friends. So maybe they are, I mean, both are, you know, in a agreement. They made an agreement of these people, or do you know something about that? Thank you.
Thanks, Gabriela. I'm not entirely sure about your question, whether you're talking about the overall penitentiary system in El Salvador, the overall total of people being detained. That I would need to check. With regard to SECOT, which of course is the focus of attention here, we don't have any official figures. It is estimated to be in the tens of thousands. I think it is a facility that has been built to house some 40,000. But as I said, we don't have access to SECOT. So we don't have any sense to really give a precise figure on that. The responsibility for these people, well, I mean, that actually is one of the key points, isn't it? Precisely given the uncertainty, given the circumstances in which we believe these people to have been taken to El Salvador, who is responsible for them ultimately? Who is responsible for their well-being? This clearly is involving the U.S. administration that sent them to El Salvador. And now they are being held in El Salvador in a prison run by El Salvador. So, of course, the Salvadoran authorities would have responsibility for their well-being as well.
Gabriela, you have a follow-up?
I have a question for Liz in another subject.
Okay, let's wait for the other subjects, please. Let's finish with this. Olivia, last question.
Hi there, thank you. You were saying there, Liz, that you have seen reports about conditions at the high security facility. Are you just able to describe in some detail what those reports seem to be saying in terms of the conditions there? And just secondly, you said that you are engaging with the El Salvadorian authorities. Just want to confirm that you've also been engaging with the US, and have you had are you satisfied with the level of engagement that you've had, if any, with them? Thank you.
Thank you for that. With regard to the specific conditions of SECOT, precisely, as I keep saying, we've not had access to it. So from our own point of view, we're not able to ascertain the conditions, but of course it's been widely reported. I think what is really of importance for us in highlighting this is the fact that our colleagues have spoken to family members, to mothers, sisters, brothers, relatives of some of the people who we believe to be held there. We've obtained information from more than 100 cases, and mostly through interviews with family members. And what we've been told, the testimonies that we have got from family members, shows that the individuals concerned were, in many cases, told hours before they were flown out that they were being deported, they were being sent to Venezuela, not El Salvador. And in some cases, the families were contacted by their loved one and asked, please come to Caracas, please come to see me there. And of course, when the plane arrived, no one was disembarked. So this added to the uncertainty, to the desperation, to the fear of the families. We've spoken about them telling us they feel completely powerless. They don't know where their loved ones are. They don't know what they're accused of. They don't know how they're being treated, and they don't know how they can ever get to see them again. So I think that's really important to really give the human context of this. We are concerned, of course, about the conditions that they're being held in, but we're really concerned about the fact that they're being held at all. We have information about you know, a number of things concerning the individuals that we believe to be held there. So given all that, given the work that we are doing via our colleagues who work on Venezuela, given the information we're getting about the individuals concerned, we are obviously engaging. We've engaged with the Salvadoran authorities, and we are engaging with the US authorities. We've been in contact with US authorities in DC and also here. So on a working level, there is constant engagement, because this is a really crucial, important issue that we are raising concerns over the fate of individuals, of people, and within that context, the lack of due process in what has happened to them.
Thank you very much. I think that's it on this matter, Liz. So you have these two additional questions. If you want to touch upon the Africans and then Afrikaners, sorry, and then we'll go to Gabriela, who has another. Yeah, I know, but maybe you want to answer these two questions. Then we go to Gabriela for her other questions, and then you have...
So I have the question that you asked, Nina, on sort of South Africans going to the US. I mean, we don't have specific information on that. We're not involved in that process. But in this case, we would underscore that, and this is a general point, of course, that it is really important to ensure equitable access to safe and legal pathways, grounded on human rights and refugee obligations and humanitarian considerations. It's really important that such protection measures are applied consistently and without discrimination, so that all individuals in need can access, can be safe and can live in dignity.
Gabriela, if it's of Venezuela, maybe you go ahead with Venezuela, then I'll give the floor to Gabriela, because maybe her question is on that. Go ahead, Liz.
Yes, thank you. This is indeed on Venezuela. The detention and enforced disappearance of critics of the Venezuelan government is continuing, fueling a climate of fear. The High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, calls on the authorities to release immediately all those arbitrarily detained and to ensure due process and fair trial standards are met. Since last year's election, human rights defenders, journalists, and others perceived as dissident voices have been subjected to intimidation and persecution, limiting the exercise of the rights to freedom of expression, association, and peaceful assembly. Among the most recent cases of concern is that of Eduardo Torres, a lawyer with the Venezuelan Education Action Program on Human Rights, who, according to credible information, was arrested on his way home in Caracas on the 9th of May. His relatives report being unable to contact him and remain unaware of his whereabouts. Our office continues to be concerned by conditions of detention, in particular, lack of access to adequate food and healthcare. Our office has verified the deaths of at least three government critics held in custody since July 2024. These cases must be fully and independently investigated. The High Commissioner urges authorities to provide promptly details on the fate and whereabouts of the missing and detained to their loved ones, and to ensure they are granted access to lawyers of their own choosing. Amid the widening restrictions on civic space, we recall that the law on the control, regulation, performance, and financing of non-governmental and related organizations is vague and undermines the rights to freedom of expression and association. This law must be repealed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Don't see a question on Venezuela in the room, so let me go to Gabriela. Again.
Yes, thank you, Alessandra. Yes, I would like to know on Venezuela if Edmundo González's son-in-law, that he was detained, if he is still in jail, or do you have any news on him? He's a son-in-law of the president candidate for the presidency of Venezuela, if you know something about that. And then I have a question on another issue, that is Afghanistan. Thank you.
Go ahead, ask your question, because you are the last one. Then we'll go to Rick on Gaza. So just ask your question, the other question.
Okay. Do you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So my question is on Afghanistan. I don't have very good memory if you already talk about this, but this is about children. It's a boy issue. And the name of this dancing boy is Basha Bashi. It's a boy's play of boys or something like that. They are dressed like girls. They dance in front of a very wealthy man, and then they are abused, sexually abused. And when their adolescence is over, I mean, their lives are totally destroyed. So I don't know if a High Commissioner or someone in your office talk about this issue. It's extremely serious issue, because it's a lot of teenagers, boys, that are in this Basha Bashi play. Maybe if you don't have the answer right now, maybe you can answer, you know, in another briefing, but it's very important.
Thank you for those two questions, Gabriela. With regard to your first one on the son-in-law, Edmundo González, according to the information available, we believe he remains detained. And obviously, this was a high-profile case, but we are following, you know, this and other cases closely. On Afghanistan, I jotted it down, but I do have a little bit of information, but you're right. I mean, it clearly, you know, seems incredibly serious. We are aware of the practice. We have addressed it extensively. So I'm being told by colleagues back at the office, we'll send you more information. And this is something apparently that some of the treaty bodies have looked into. So we'll send you some information on that. But thank you for raising it.
Thank you very much. I think we still have one question from
Yes, thank you. Yes, I'm here. On Venezuela, if you could let us know what is the state of relations with your office and Venezuela. I know you were having discussions about opening an office there. Where are you?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for that. What information I do have is that we currently have one international colleague actually in Venezuela. And then we have about 15 other colleagues that are working from Panama covering Venezuela. This situation is what we currently have, and this is while we wait for an agreement to deploy more colleagues. But if I may just underscore the importance of our office or of our colleagues who have been in Venezuela, going back to the families of the people that we believe are being held in El Salvador, that the families did approach us. You know, did want to come and talk to us, seeking help. And so our colleagues are noting down information on each individual case that comes to their attention, you know, talking about, you know, the name of the person, the age of the person, what they did, all manner of details, because we think this is really important. So the talks are ongoing, but currently one in Venezuela and 15 others working from Panama. Thank you.
Liz, thank you very much for all this information. We will have more on human rights with Tamin later on, but I would like now to go to Gaza and to Rick Peppercorn, who has been patiently waiting with Margaret on my left, and then we will hear from Tamin on Egypt. So let's change region, yeah, and go to the Middle East. You want to start, or I go straight to Rick? Rick, good morning. Thanks for waiting, and thanks for being here to give us an update on the situation situation in Gaza. Just wanted to call your attention to what we said yesterday about the Secretary General's alarm by the findings that were released yesterday, that one in every five people in Gaza is facing starvation, while the entire population is facing high level of acute food insecurity and the risk of famine. And that was what was found in the latest snapshot produced by the IPC. Rick, you have more on the situation of health, so I'll give you the floor now. Thanks.
Thank you very much, and good morning to everyone. Greetings from Gaza, from Deir Bala. Yes, I would like to focus definitely a bit on the food security, the general situation, and I want to say also something about the mission. I was on WHO mission to the north for the whole day, visiting four hospitals. I will come back to that later. So on food security, I mean, we all watched the launch of the IPC, and the risk of famine in Gaza is increasing with deliberate withholding of humanitarian aid, including food, in the ongoing blockade. And the latest food security analysis by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Partnership shows that indeed the entire 2.1 million population Gaza is facing prolonged food shortages, with nearly 500,000 of people, if the situation persists, in a catastrophic situation of hunger, acute malnutrition, starvation, illness, and death. The other million will be severely affected, and another half a million moderately affected if this situation persists. So this is one of the world's worst hunger crises, and it unfolds to us in real time. Since the aid blockade began on 2 March 2025, we get reports from the Ministry of Health that 55 children have reportedly died from the effects of malnutrition. And if the situation persists again, this dire situation persists, nearly 71,000 children under the age of five are expected to be acutely malnourished over the next 11 months. So what we actually see in Gaza, that people are trapped in this whole cycle where a lack of food, lack of diversified food, well, malnutrition and disease fuel each other. Healthcare increasingly out of reach, vaccine coverage, of course, plummeting, access to clean water and sanitation severely limited. 90% of the Gazans lack access to safe water. And increased child protection concerns is always, of course, the most vulnerable who get hit first. So the risk of severe illness and death grows, especially for children suffering from severe acute malnutrition who urgently need treatment to survive. Also, pregnant and breastfeeding mothers are also at high risk of malnutrition. Situation persists with nearly 70,000 expected to require treatment for acute malnutrition over the next 11 months. We all know that the long-term damage from malnutrition can last a lifetime. Form of stunted growth, impaired cognitive development, poor health, etc. So without enough nutritious food, clean water, access to healthcare, an entire generation will be permanently affected. And I want to make this point. Before this crisis, acute malnutrition rates among under five were minimal. We talk about 0.6 to 0.8%. There was no malnutrition among pregnant and lactating women in Gaza. There was some micronutrient deficiency, iron deficiency among a smaller group of pregnant women. So the aid blockade and the shrinking humanitarian access continue to undermine WHO ability to support. We support, together, by the way, with our partners, UNICEF, 16 outpatient and 3 inpatient malnutrition treatment centers with life-saving supplies and to sustain the broader health system. The remaining supplies in the WHO stocks inside Gaza are only enough to treat another 500 children with acute malnutrition, a fraction of the urgent needs. So we call, WHO calls for the protection of healthcare, for immediate end to the aid blockade, which is starving people, obstructing their right to health, and robbing them of dignity and hope. WHO and NSF repeatedly stated that calls also for the release of all hostages for a ceasefire which leads to a lasting peace. I want to say something more personal on the mission I went on yesterday. So from the south, we brought in 3 trucks of medical supplies from our warehouses here in the south to the north, essential medicine, medical supplies, and some equipment for surveillance. We also deployed an emergency medical team. And then we made assessments of four hospitals. I went to Kamala One in the north, in Jabalia, to Patient Friendly, Al Ahli, and Shifa. There's a few positives, but too many negatives. Kamala One in the north. There is an what we call a nutrition screening center, an outpatient department nutrition screening center supported by us, just the same as patient-friendly hospital, including a little inpatient ward and a nutrition stabilization center supported by WHO. Currently, they see more than 300 kids per day for screening. And in you saw it in front of your eyes in Kamala One. They have approximately 11% of the kids they screen. They have what we call generalized acute malnutrition. And a few of them are more severe, are taking inside. In Patient Friendly, they even showed us the rates that they clock rates of over 20% of the kids they screen. They have generalized acute malnutrition. We went to a few wards as well. The other thing, what we of course heard from everyone, from all the directors, the in the hospitals, the health workers, etc., the lack of all kind of essential supplies. And we've raised this for months now, like our stocks are dwindling in our warehouses, and we are the main provider for essential medicine and medical supplies. So the key items which are lacking are, of course, everything related to trauma, trauma fixators, trauma blood products, everything related to trauma care, but also antibiotics, also very simple, I would say, essential medicines as insulin for diabetes, the more complex one for cancer and oncology. And what they raise constantly with this, because they see so many, again, trauma cases, disinfectants, cleaning material, as we see a high rate of completely unnecessary infection rates, because there's a lack of infection prevention and control at those facilities. Now, also what I want to raise is that when talking to the people in the north, and specifically to the people in the market, it was crowded. It was packed. People walk around. They try to make some life. They try to survive. And even the few staff we have from ourselves, they are still. And everywhere I asked, you know, like, what are you going to do? What are your plans? And people are, and maybe it's irrealistic. I don't hope it's irrealistic. They're hopeful. They're hopeful there will be a ceasefire. But they definitely told me that they have no plans to leave. They feel that there's nowhere safe to go. They have been, most of them, they have left and they have been forced to leave many, many times. They don't want to leave again. And of course, you can only hope that that the world is not letting them down again. Let me stop here.
Rick, thank you very much. This is an important update. So let me open the floor to questions now. Yeah, I'll start with Reuters. Emma?
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for the briefing. We're hearing initial reports of an airstrike on Nasser Hospital. I'm wondering if you have any confirmation your side, and if so, can you say how bad the situation is? And a second question on supplies. Is there any contingency planning on getting supplies inside Gaza, and can you give us any details? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, let me go to the Nasser Medical Complex. Of course, we also heard this morning, and let me go, because I want to be very clear. So what we get, it's reported to us, etc., because I was supposed to actually go there today, but I had other meetings, so I couldn't attend. So on the attacks of Nasser Medical Complex, so the burn unit of Nasser Medical Complex is reportedly hit on 13 May, resulting in 2 fatalities and 12 injuries. That's reported to us. One of the injured individuals is in critical condition, is currently undergoing multiple surgical operation. So the impact on the hospital infrastructure, 18 hospital beds are lost in the surgical department, 8 ICU beds, and you know how critical they are, and 10 inpatient beds. For us, of course, healthcare is not a target, and WHO calls for protection of healthcare. On the contingency planning, so what we are trying to do, and not just WHO, we try to see with partners here in Gaza what is left for essential medicine, medical supplies, and equipment. And also, I can tell you that WHO, we have managed to retrieve a lot of equipment, for example, from hospitals, which were damaged or destroyed. I mean, talk to Turkish hospital, we removed the oxygen plant, which is now in Shifa, and a lot of other ICU beds, etc., from one place to the other. So we've done that constantly. We're looking now at essential medicines, medical supplies still available, including in our own stocks, and we have to be as careful as possible and prioritize with partners. We have seen, of course, a lot of restriction in our movements. I want to make that point as well. We have seen a lot of restrictions there. On the contingency, but we have raised this, we are raising this every week in our discussions with COGAT and Israeli authorities, and specifically on health and the health products which are most needed. And for your information, I mean, like, and there's 31 WHO trucks ready in Al-Arish, yeah, but supplies cannot be moved. We also have supplies in the West Bank, blood products, etc., which could be there in any day when this is allowed. Overall, yeah, so we make our plans for whenever the blockade is lifted, and we constantly raise with everyone around the world, including Israeli authorities, the need to get these supplies in now. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Beza. Beza is our correspondent of Anadolu Anzi.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, Rick. I want to return to the IPC report, as Alessandra mentioned, which said the whole population is at critical risk of famine. Does WHO fears that the starvation becoming the main cause of that in Gaza if the borders are kept being closed? And the secondly, how reversible the situation is, as no aid being allowed for a long time now? How much time there is not to reach an irreversible point in the region? Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's some complex questions. In my first, I want to make the point that the IPC report is very clear. So if this situation persists, 500,000 people are at risk of starvation. I mean, like that, 1 million people will be severely affected. Yeah, over the coming 4 or 5 months, and another 500,000 will be moderately affected. Now, there is, of course, also, it's not just the lack of general foods and diversified foods. I've raised already the lack of access to safe water, which is the case. That's a real issue, the lack of access to safe water. The, I would say, completely inadequate shelter conditions. And that, of course, we've seen the whole food system collapsing. There's no fisheries, there's no poultry anymore, there's no agriculture. So I think this is, I would say, this is in combined. And also what I saw yesterday again in hospitals, there was a lot of kids at that hospitals, in hospital wards, which, and that's not surprising, pneumonia and gastroenteritis. Well, those kids are, of course, are also very, when you also then have a lack of proper food or food supplies, etc., pneumonia can hit much harder and can become suddenly and incredibly serious disease, and you can die from that. So you normally don't die from starvation, you die from the diseases associated to that. I think you ask about reversal and reversed. I mean, this blockade should stop, and diverse food supplies should get in. And there's a system in place to bring that around Gaza. So that should happen at first place. So bakeries should work again. The the desalination plant should work, that we get proper water supplies back, etc., etc. And then, of course, for specifically more focus directly on WHO, essential medicines, medical supplies, and equipment. Over to you.
Thank you very much. Nina Larsson, AFP.
Yes. Hi, Eric. Thank you for this briefing. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the 55 children that you mentioned who have reportedly died due to malnutrition causes. If you have any more details on that, if you've seen such deaths yourself, or if these are just reports. Thank you.
Thank you very much. No, these are reported to us. What I can say, what we see in our staff see, we see an increase because we try to monitor as good as possible. And of course, the health information is complex, but this is monitored and not just by middle upper arm circumferences, but also weight for height, et cetera, et cetera. And what we see is an increasing trend in generalized acute malnutrition. And we see also an increasing number of severely acute malnourished kids. Yeah, and I've seen them as well at wards. I mean, that child of 5 years old, and I saw she was 2.5 or something like that, you know, like that's that kind of things. Yeah, we have seen. I've not seen myself, let's say, the death related to that. So, no, I cannot confirm that. This is reported to us. Over to you.
If there are no other questions, I'll go to the platform. John Zarokostas, France 24.
Good morning, Rick. Can you hear me there?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Thank you. Yeah, good. Following up on Nina's question, do you have some estimates for us? You mentioned 71,000 children suffering from acute malnourishment. Do we have any estimates on how many are suffering from severe acute malnutrition, and also how many children at present are being treated for severe acute malnutrition in some of the facilities that you're supporting? Thank you.
I think the number of something you mentioned, I mean, the IPC report, it clearly says if the situation persists, yeah, then it's expected that 71,000 children under the age of 5 are expected to become acutely malnourished over the next 11 months. That is what the IPC report said. I didn't say 71,000. I want to make it very clear, are acutely malnourished now. Please, I mean, like, I hope that you get that clear. We will try to get some data about how many children are treated. What we have are the data for currently in those 16 outpatient departments, malnutrition screening centers, how many kids are screened, how many one of them are classified as generalized acute malnutrition, and then indeed like and the smallest number of them, which is indeed like more severely moderate or more severely acute malnourished. Yeah, there are data for that. I will try to get it. And if we get it on time, we will include it in the brief as well. Over to you.
Thank you, Rick.
Of course, not. I want to say it's not easy. That's another thing we try to do, health information system. We try to focus together with the partners on a more limited set of data and try to do that well. And of course, mother and child health is an extremely important component of that. There's more data than that. And that I try to make sure that data are as reliable as possible. Over to you.
Thank you. Nika Mimbrus, New York Times.
Yeah, thank you for the briefing, Rick. Just in relation to the 55 children who died, in what period of time is that? Since when has that happened? Thank you.
I think that was since the aid blockade began on the 2nd of March, yeah, this year. This has been reported to us that 57 children have reportedly died from the effects of malnutrition, according to the Ministry of Health. Again, I want to stress, you know that as well, children don't die from malnutrition. They often die of the underlying, the associated diseases, pneumonia, or pneumonia is a very big one, of course, or other diseases. Over to you.
That's awful. Other questions to Rick? I don't see any other hand up. Just before we close with Gaza, just a reminder that this afternoon at 3 p.m. New York time, so if I'm not wrong, it's 9 o'clock here, the Security Council will hold a briefing on the humanitarian situation and protection of aid workers in Gaza. And I'm the Secretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, Tom Fletcher, is expected to brief, so he will probably have more on the humanitarian situation in Gaza. Rick, thank you so much for this update. Stay safe and come back and update us as soon as possible again on this extremely dire situation. Margaret, do you have anything to add?
No, just
your mic.
Just that the notes have been sent out, so they all the notes that Rick was referring to have been sent out, so you should have those in your inbox.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Margaret and Rick. On my right, Tamin. Thank you. Tamin Alkitan for OHCHR. You have a briefing point on Egypt.
Yes, good morning. Thank you, Alessandra. We have closely followed the passage of Egypt's new Code of Criminal Procedure, which was recently approved by the House of Representatives and is now pending presidential approval. We have raised concerns over provisions of the law that will grant public prosecutors broad discretionary powers related to pretrial detention, interception of communications, and travel bans. The law would also provide for other measures adversely impacting the right to effective legal representation and on accountability for the conduct of public officials, including law enforcement personnel. Last-minute amendments were reportedly made to the draft law before it was sent to the president for his approval. However, these changes have not been made public, raising concerns about lack of legislative transparency. We call on the president of Egypt to consider carefully the proposed criminal procedure code in light of these concerns prior to granting any assent, in order to ensure that it fully complies with Egypt's international human rights obligations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tamin, for this. Is there any question? I don't see any here on the platform, no. There is neither. So thank you very much, Tamin, for this point. If there are, that concludes our list of speakers. Margaret has one last point. It's about the press conference, right?
Yeah. Sorry for quite last minute information, but kindly the palace agreed to do the our press briefing at the launch of the World Health Statistics that normally we would do from WHO headquarters, but because of the preparations for the WHA, kindly the palace agreed to host it. So it'll be Dr. Samira Asma, the Assistant Director General for Data Analytics and Delivery for Impact, and two of our senior statisticians, and there's some really interesting material in this particular compendium, really looking at what went off track during the pandemic. And I know we've said that before in our World Health Statistics, but this is really the strongest analysis of what went off track and where we're now coming back in terms of life expectancy and other illnesses, disease states that affect the human population. So an interesting one that's going to be at 2 o'clock here on Thursday.
Thank you very much, Margaret. I don't know if there's any question, last-minute question to Margaret, too. Don't see any. So just a couple of, thank you, Margaret. A couple of announcements. We have the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which is concluding this morning the review of the report of Norway. Then we will have Indonesia, Iraq, Romania, Qatar, and Brazil. And I also wanted to remind you that the Secretary General has traveled yesterday to Europe. Let me take my notes, sorry. To Germany, to be more precise, to attend the UN peacekeeping ministerial that is kicking off now, actually, while we are speaking. He will be joined in Berlin by the, he has joined by the Undersecretary General for Peace Operation, Jean-Pierre Lacroix, Undersecretary General for Operational Support, Atul Khare, and Undersecretary General for Management Strategy, Policy and Compliance, Catherine Pollard. This meeting, and especially this morning, at lunchtime, in fact, at 1 o'clock, the high-level opening of the ceremony, the Secretary General is expected to give a keynote remarks that will focus on the future of peacekeeping. We've sent you the remark under embargo, and he will underscore the importance of the work of our Blue Helmets and the sacrifices they make. He will also touch upon contributions to peacekeeping during these tough times for the financing of our work across the board. And just to remind you that the meeting provides a platform for delegations to announce pledges. That's what we hope, in support to our peacekeeping operations. This is going to be all webcast. The Secretary General remarks should start at 1 p.m. Although I have seen that the connection has already started on UN Web TV, so please don't hesitate to go and listen to him at 1 p.m. Of course, the embargoed remarks are to be checked against delivery. Just a last point on the fact that the SG is also scheduled to meet the hosts, the German officials that are hosting the meeting, and this includes the Chancellor of Germany, Friedrich Merz, as well as other leaders and officials attending the global event. Tomorrow, the press, there will be a press conference by Chancellor Merz and the Secretary General. We will inform you about the time. It should be also on UN Web TV, so you will be able to follow it. And then the Secretary General will be traveling to Iraq to attend the League of Arab States summits, which is taking place in Baghdad on the 17th of May. I think I have told you all I had. John has a question.
Yes, Alessandra, I don't know if Margaret's still there. I just wanted to
yes,
ask
she is.
If we are getting the material on embargo ahead of the press conference, the statistics publication, if we're getting it on embargo, otherwise it's very hard to ask questions if we haven't seen the material.
Yeah. Especially with a statistical.
That's a good point, John. I'm really pressing to get that for you. And as soon as I know that I've got copies, I think we'll put out something separate saying the materials are available. Currently, they're not. We actually won't do the press conference on Monday. So, as soon as I know, I'll let you know. We do have a press release, which I know is not nearly as good as having the actual materials. But I'll do my very best to get them available as early as possible, because I quite agree. This is a really meaty subject, and you need to eat the meat in order to be able to digest and come up with some good questions.
Yeah, indeed. So you keep them informed, Margaret, and we will keep you informed about the press conference of the Secretary General with Chancellor Merz tomorrow. If it happens on Web TV, we'll send you the link. So I think that concludes our briefing. I don't see other hands up. So thank you very much, and I'll see you on Friday. Thank you.